Chapter 3. We have to clear and clean up our minds. Now, one thing is fairly plain to most of us who are waking up to the need of living our lives in a new way and of making over the state, which is the framework of our lives, to meet the new demands upon it, and that is that we have to put our own minds in order. Why have we only awakened now to the crisis in human affairs? The changes in progress have been going on with steady acceleration for a couple of centuries. Clearly, we must all have been very unobservant. Our knowledge, as it came to us, must have been very badly arranged in our minds, and our way of dealing with it must have been cloudy and muddled, or else we should surely have awakened long ago to the immense necessities that now challenge us. And if that is so, if it has taken decades to rouse us, then quite probably we are not yet completely awake. We may still have much to get plain in our minds, and we certainly have much more to learn. One primary and permanent duty, therefore, is to go on with our thinking and to think as well as we can about the way in which we think and about the ways in which we get and use knowledge. Fundamentally, the open conspiracy must be an intellectual rebirth. Human thought is still very much confused by the imperfection of the words and other symbols it employs, and the consequences of this confused thinking are much more serious and extensive than is commonly realized. We still see the world through a mist of words. It is only the things immediately about us that are plain fact. Through symbols, and especially through words, man has raised himself above the level of the ape and come to a considerable mastery over his universe. But every step in his mental ascent has involved entanglement with these symbols and words he was using. They were at once helpful and very dangerous and misleading. A great part of our affairs, social, political, intellectual, is in a perplexing and dangerous state today because of our loose, uncritical, slovenly use of words. All through the later Middle Ages, there were great disputes among the schoolmen about the use of words and symbols. There is a queer disposition in the human mind to think that symbols and words and logical deductions are truer than actual experiences. And these great controversies were due to the struggle of the human intelligence against that disposition. On the one side were the realists, who were so called because they believed, in effect, that names were more real than facts. And on the other side were the nominalists, who from the first were pervaded by a suspicion about names and words generally, who thought there might be some sort of catch in verbal processes, and who gradually worked their way towards verification by experiment, which is the fundamental thing about experimental science. Experimental science, which has given our human world all these immense powers and possibilities that tempt and threaten it today. These controversies of the schoolmen were of the utmost importance to mankind. The modern world could not begin to come into existence until the human mind had broken away from the narrow-minded verbalist way of thinking which the realists followed. But all through my education, I never had this matter explained to me. The University of London intimated that I was a soundly educated young man by giving me a degree in first-class honors and the liberty to acquire and wear an elegant gown and hood, and the London College of Preceptors gave me and the world its highest assurances that I was fit to educate and train the minds of my fellow creatures. And yet, I still had to discover that a realist was not a novelist who put rather too highly flavored sex appeal into his books, and a nominalist nothing in particular. But it had crept into my mind as I learnt about individuality in my biological work and about logic and psychology in my preparation as the perfect preceptor, that something very important and essential was being left out, and that I wasn't at all as well equipped as my diplomas presently said I was. And in the next few years, I found the time to clean up this matter pretty thoroughly. I made no marvelous discoveries. Everything I found out was known already. Nevertheless, I had to find out some of this stuff for myself quite over again, as though it had never been done. So inaccessible was any complete account of human thinking to an ordinary man who wanted to get his mind into proper working condition. And this was not that I had missed some recondite, precious refinements of philosophy. It was that my fundamental thinking, at the very root of my political and social conduct, was wrong. I was in a human community, and that community, and I with it, was thinking of phantoms and fantasies as though they were real and living things, was in a reverie of unrealities, was blind, slovenly, hypnotized, base, and ineffective, blundering about in an extremely beautiful and an extremely dangerous world. I set myself to re-educate myself, and after the practice of writers, wrote it in various trial pamphlets, essays, and books. There is no need to refer to these books here. The gist of the matter is set out in three compilations to which I shall refer again almost immediately. They are The Outline of History, Chapter 21, Paragraph 6, and Chapter 33, Paragraph 6, The Science of Life, Book 8, On Thought and Behavior, and The Work, Wealth, and Happiness of Mankind, Chapter 2, Paragraphs 1 through 4. In the last, it is shown quite plainly how man has had to struggle for the mastery of his mind, has discovered only after great controversies the proper and effective use of his intellectual tools, and has had to learn to avoid certain widespread traps and pitfalls before he could achieve his present mastery over matter. Thinking clearly and effectively does not come by nature. Hunting the truth is an art. We blunder naturally into a thousand misleading generalizations and false processes, Yet there is hardly any intelligent mental training done in the schools of the world today. We have to learn this art if we are to practice it at all. Our school teachers have had no proper training themselves. They miseducate by example and precept. And so it is that our press and current discussions are more like an impromptu riot of crippled and deaf and blind minds than an intelligent interchange of ideas. What bosh, one reads. What rash and impudent assumptions. What imbecile inferences. But re-educating oneself, getting one's mind into health and exercising it and training it to think properly, is only the beginning of the task before the awakening open conspirator. He has not only to think clearly, but he has to see that his mind is equipped with the proper general ideas to form a true framework for his everyday judgments and decisions. It was the Great War first brought home to me how ignorant I was and how ill-finished and untidy my mind about the most important things of life. That disastrous waste of life, material, and happiness, since it was practically worldwide, was manifestly the outcome of the processes that constitute the bulk of history. And yet I found I did not know, and nobody else seemed to know, history in such a fashion as to be able to explain how the Great War came about, or what ought to come out of it. Versailles, we all seem to be agreed nowadays, was silly. But how could Versailles be anything else than what it was in view of the imperfect, lopsided historical knowledge and the consequent suspicion, emotion, and prejudice of those who assembled there? They did not know any better than the rest of us what the war was, and so how could they know what the peace ought to be? I perceived that I was in the same case with everyone else, and I set myself first of all for my own guidance to make a summary of all history and get some sort of map to more serviceable conclusions about the political state of mankind. This summary I made was the outline of history, a shameless compilation and arrangement of the main facts of the world story, written without a touch of art or elegance, written, indeed, in a considerable hurry and excitement, and its sale, which is now in 3rd million, showed how much I had in common with a great dispersed crowd of ordinary people, all wanting to know, all disgusted with the patriotic, litigious, twaddling, gossipy stuff given them as history by their schoolmasters and schoolmistresses, which had led them into the disaster of the war. The outline of history is not the whole history of life. Its main theme is the growth of human intercommunication and human communities and their rulers and conflicts. The story of how and why the myriads of little tribal systems of 10,000 years ago have fought and coalesced into the 60 or 70 odd governments of today and are now straining and laboring in the grip of forces that must presently accomplish their final unison. And even as I completed the outline, I realized that there remained outside its scope wider and more fundamental and closer, more immediate fields of knowledge which I still had to get in order for my own practical ends and the ends of like-minded people who wanted to use their lives effectively if my existence was to escape futility. I realized that I did not know enough about the life in my body and its relations to the world of life and matter outside it to come to proper decisions about a number of urgent matters, from race conflicts, birth control, and my private life, to the public control of health and the conservation of natural resources. And also, I found, I was astonishingly ignorant about the everyday business of life, the how and why of the miner who provided the coal to cook my dinner, and the banker who took my money in return for a checkbook, and the shopkeeper from whom I bought things, and the policeman who kept the streets in order for me. Yet I was voting for laws affecting my relations with these people, paying them directly or indirectly, airing my ignorant opinions about them, and generally contributing by my behavior to sustain and affect their lives. So, with the aid and direction of two very competent biologists, I set to work to get out as plain and clear a statement as possible of what was known about the sources and nature of life and the relation of species to individuals and to other species and the processes of consciousness and thought. This I published as the science of life. And while this was going on, I set myself to the task of making a review of all human activities in relation to each other, the work of people and the needs of people, cultivation, manufacture, trade, direction, government, and all. This was the most difficult part of this attempt to get a rational account of the modern world, and it called for the help and counsel of a great variety of people. I had to ask and find some general answer to the question, what are the 1,900-odd million human beings who are alive today doing? And how and why are they doing it? It was, in fact, an outline of economic, social, and political science. But since, after the outline of history, the word outline has been a good deal cheapened by various enterprising publishers, I have called it the work, wealth, and happiness of mankind. Now I find, by getting these three correlated compilations into existence, I have at last, in however rough a fashion, brought together a complete system of ideas upon which an open conspirator can go. Before anyone could hope to get on to anything like a practical working directive answer to, what are we to do with our lives? It was necessary to know what our lives were, the science of life, what had led up to their present pattern, the outline of history, and this third book to tell what we were actually doing and supposed to be doing with our working lives, day by day, at the present time. By the time I was through with these books, I felt I had really something sound and comprehensive to go upon, an ideology, as people say, on which it was possible to think of building a new world without fundamental surprises, and moreover, that I had got my mind stripped down and cleansed of many illusions and bad habits so that it could handle life with an assurance it had never known before. There is nothing marvelous about these compilations of mine. Any steady writer of average intelligence with the same will and the same resources, who could devote about 9 or 10 years to the task and get the proper sort of help, could have made them. It can be done. It is no doubt being done all over again by other people, for themselves and perhaps for others, much more beautifully and adequately. But to get that amount of vision and knowledge, to achieve that general arrangement and understanding, was a necessary condition that had to be satisfied before any answer to the question, "What are we to do with our lives?" could even be attempted, and before one could become in any effective way an open conspirator. There is nothing indispensable even now, I repeat, about these three particular books. I know about them and refer to them because I put them together myself, and so they are handy for me to explain myself. But most of what they contain can be extracted from any good encyclopedia. Any number of people have made similar outlines of history for themselves, have read widely, grasped the leading principles of biology, and grappled with the current literature of business science, and do not in the least need my particular summary. So far as history and biology are concerned, there are parallel books that are as good and serviceable. Van Loon's books, for example. Yet, even for the highly educated people, these summaries may be useful in bringing things known with different degrees of thoroughness into a general scheme. They correlate and they fill up gaps. Between them, they cover the ground, and in some fashion, that ground has to be covered before the mind of a modern citizen is prepared to tackle the problems that confront it. Otherwise, he is an incapable citizen. He does not know where he is and where the world is. And if he is rich or influential, he may be a very dangerous citizen indeed. Presently, there will be far better compilations to meet this need, or perhaps the gist of all three divisions of knowledge concentrated and made more lucid and attractive may be available as the intellectual frame of modern education throughout the world as a general account of life that should be given to everyone. But certainly, no one can possibly set about living properly and satisfactorily unless he knows what he is, where he is, and how he stands to the people and things about him. End of chapter 3.